Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're in the home stretch now for this year's Supreme Court term, with some very consequential decisions due to come down before the end of the month, like on asking every person in the census next year if they're a U.S. citizen, redistricting cases that might do a lot to determine which party controls Congress after the elections next year, an obscure double jeopardy case involving someone's drug and gun law violations that might actually have implications for Trump world after the Mueller investigation, and more. There are two decisions that came down this morning, none of the above major ones. With me now to help us know what to look for and what to look for this morning is Jamie Floyd, host of WNYC's All Things Considered, and our legal analyst. Hi, Jamie.
Good morning, Brian.
First, what did happen this morning?
Well, two decisions not impacting our area, but of course impacting our country. The Supreme Court siding with an Alabama company over the U.S. Postal Service in a patent dispute. So the Postal Service losing out there, the company winning, the government losing, and the Supreme Court ruling against workers on oil drilling platforms off of California, who argued they should be paid for the off-work time they spend on the platform, including sleeping. They sleep on the platform. Mm-hmm. They feel they should be paid. They'd be sleeping elsewhere, clearly, if they weren't working on that drilling. And the Supreme Court ruling against workers there. We'll have coverage on that, of course, on All Things Considered later this afternoon. But none of those on the top watch list, as we call it. You can also go to SCOTUS blog if you're interested. Mm-hmm. But Nina Totenberg does fine analysis of all things Supreme Court, and she'll be drilling down on these.
So you are predicting that Nina Totenberg will be drilling down on platform story.
Pun intended,
on
Brian.
This afternoon's All Things Considered. Okay, so let's talk about the biggies that we're waiting for. The citizenship question,
yes,
on the 2020 census, known as Department of Commerce versus New York.
Yes.
New York is the...
Yeah, well, a number of states filed on this, and it was argued back in April. New York and other states that would be significantly impacted if this census question were to be added. And the question is a simple one, Brian. Is this person a citizen of the United States? That's what Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, and the Trump administration want to add to the census. The last time the question was asked was in 1950. Wilbur Ross says he wants to add it because he said, in arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court and other federal judges along the way, that the Department of Justice needed this information to enforce the Voting Rights Act. Well, we know the Voting Rights Act came along in 1965. So it was being enforced all along without this question, because the question was last asked in 1950. And it has come to light since the argument before the U.S. Supreme Court in the documents of a now deceased political operative of the Republican Party, that there may have been other, it clearly is the fact that there were other motivations for this question, and that was the suspicion all along. And so now the question is, will the U.S. Supreme Court rule differently because they have an indication that is not in the record? That the motivation was different on the part of the government.
And not just different, we should say, and we've talked about this on the show before, but for people who don't know the story, these emails got revealed,
yes,
just the other week from this Republican strategist who has since died.
In the 11th hour.
In the 11th hour, in legal terms, as the justices consider this case, that said, a good reason to pursue a citizenship question is because it will result in more electoral power,
right,
for non-Hispanic whites and for Republicans.
Right. And the two issues before the court are whether the Commerce Secretary is within his powers in doing this. And the other question is whether it's unconstitutional to do this, because the Constitution requires the census, and the census requires a count of every person here. Not just U.S. citizens, every person here. And the question, the factual question, is whether this will result in an undercount. And it matters desperately because it affects resources and it also affects representation in our legislature. So people need to understand the critically important and constitutional, this is a constitutional question of the highest order for the U.S. Supreme Court. And they didn't have all of the evidence at the time the case was argued, nor do they have time to put it over to next year for re-argument, because the census begins now, essentially now.
So can the judges legally, or would they, based on their own practices, take into account this 11th hour piece of evidence that surfaced after they heard oral arguments? Because certainly the Republicans will push back, as I've heard some of them do in the media, about this piece of evidence that says this isn't the only reason that they did it. This isn't even a reason, because those were would certainly be illegitimate reasons that they did it. This is just one possible outcome that was predicted by a strategist in a document that was circulated some time ago.
Right. What's amazing about this, Brian, this document was actually relevant to another case. This man was working on two cases. He was working on the other top line critically important cases of redistricting, of gerrymandering, which we'll talk about in a minute. I'm sure you're going to go right to those.
Right to those.
And his daughter turned this document over to the lawyers in that case, and they said, oh my goodness, the census implication here is critical. And he actually writes very specifically in the memo about the census, about this question, recommending this question. So it clearly goes to the census case. But your question, Brian, is can the justices consider evidence that is not argued before them? And, you know, I'm not the Supreme Court scholar that someone like Jeffrey Rosen is of the U.S. Constitution Center, but I feel fairly confident in saying, no, they're not supposed to consider evidence not in the record. They're supposed to look at the four corners of the record. And look, we're talking about lots of record here, amicus briefs, multiple states filing as petitioners, and then, of course, the respondent federal government. But they really are supposed to stick to the record before them. They could open for re-argument if they had time, and then this would be entered into the record, but there is not time. And I did a little bit of quick research coming here to see if they've ever extended in the history of the court the term. And I could not find a record of that. Maybe one of our very astute listeners wants to call in and say, oh, yes, they went to August one year. But I could not find a record of that.
All right. Listeners, who has a question for our legal analyst and all things considered host, Jamie Floyd, on any of the big cases that the Supreme Court will rule on before the end of this month? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or if you're a worker who just woke up from your night's sleep on a drilling platform and you want to comment on the case they decided today, 212-433-9692.
And before we move from citizenship, I know we have a lot to cover. I don't think the justices are going to feel they need that extra information. The five who are predisposed to rule, Justice Roberts is the tension here, Kennedy now being gone. The five who are predisposed to rule for the government will say, the rest of it doesn't matter. This is within the right and realm of the Commerce Department and the federal government to ask this question. And the other four are going to come to the bench and read, I predict, very impassioned dissents about why this question is discriminatory, unfair, and depressing the count, and unconstitutional.
That some conservatives say, if there are a ton of non-citizens, not to mention a ton of undocumented immigrants in an area, why should they get to count toward increasing the voting power of a district?
It's not just about voting power. It's about representational power and critically important resources that come to an area based on the population in that area.
Exactly. And that, and to be clear, the claim by the conservatives is not that these non-citizens are going to vote illegally. It's that they get counted, and therefore the areas with a lot of non-citizens, including undocumented non-citizens, they get a little more representational strength if everybody's counted.
Yes. And there's one other thing to think about. Those who are here legally are afraid as well.
Yes.
They are afraid as well. All sorts of people become afraid to participate in federal government counts because they're afraid of their federal government. And that is clearly not what the census envisions. The census envisions full participation by all who are here. And we're creating a climate, again, of fear. Not just of those who are undocumented, but those who are documented, those who are here legally, those who've served time in prison, many, many people who are afraid to put their name on a piece of paper because they don't trust their federal government.
One other thing on this before we move on. How can it be unconstitutional today to ask the citizenship question if it wasn't unconstitutional up through 1950 when it was done?
Well, it may have been unconstitutional. That's
just
number one.
Challenged
right.
It.
But it has to do with two specific things. Well, a number of things. The administrative, there's an administrative process for making changes to the census that was not done here, a three-stage testing process that they just blew right past and they haven't done it because they don't have the resources. They didn't have the time. They didn't think it through. They haven't done it right. So there's that.
Or
and
they,
the court may look at that.
Or they think they can get away with anything just because they say so. There is a law called the Administrative Procedure Act.
Correct.
Right?
Exactly right.
That they're supposed to follow those procedures before making changes
and that
to
was,
how the census is conducted.
And that was heavily argued in the court, and the four I predict will dissent will rely on that. But also, even before we got to the Trump administration, the Census Bureau has been desperately under-resourced. And Republican and Democratic administrations will tell you that. But also, there's the question of intent. There's a question of intent, and that was argued as well. What was the intent in adding the question now versus in 1950, now when we have a far more diverse country and we're living in this climate of fear?
Since there is so much interest in this particular case, I'm going to take a phone call and extend this portion of our conversation.
It's your show, Brian.
Even a little bit more. Ray on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ray.
Yeah, I just wanted to say this is really a non-topic because if you ignore everything and don't go online and fill it out, eventually you'll get one to fill out and send back. And the question is on there, are you a citizen of the United States?
But what about people who, Ray, won't fill it out?
But I think Ray's raising a different point.
Yeah.
And I think the point is that in some of the off years, because the Census Bureau is always surveying the public in what they call the American Community Survey,
right.
As you know, every 2 years, I think it is, you know, not just the big census every 10 years. In the American Community Survey, some years they do ask if you're a citizen. And that's, I think that was one of the arguments by the this is okay side.
Right, and that is different from the census because it's not used for the same purposes of representation and apportionment of resources. It's part of essentially the testing process. It's valuable, but it hasn't been challenged as unconstitutional.
Right.
I didn't realize Ray was asking about that. The real question is, will people participate in the census in 2020? It's interesting that he said go online, because that's another concern about this census coming up. They're going to try and do a lot of it online, and many people aren't online. So will that depress the result?
Let me digress for a minute to something that I was going to raise with Susan Page, but we didn't have time. Because so many people were calling about Bryan Cranston, ha ha ha. But in the Iowa caucuses this year, for the first time, I don't know if you've heard this, people are going to be able to vote online.
Yeah, no.
In addition to going in person to caucus, which was always the hallmark of the Iowa caucuses. Of course, the downside of that is that for people who work during those evening hours, or for people who have any kinds of disabilities or limitations to get out to a caucus site in person on a cold January, February night, you know, that it was discriminatory. Now they're going to be able to vote online, but no matter how many people vote online, all those online votes are only going to count for 10% of the total.
Oh.
Whoever shows up to the caucuses in person are going to count, according to USA Today this morning, are going to count for 90% of the total vote as it's tabulated in the Iowa caucuses. It seems to me there could be a one-person, one-vote constitutional challenge to that.
I had heard about the online voting. I hadn't heard about the 90-10%.
That's what
dichotomy. It's not a dichotomy. It's precisely not a dichotomy.
It's whatever the word for 9-to-1 dichotomy would
be. Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. The whole magic of the Iowa caucus is that you're caucusing. It's not a caucus if you're online.
Right. But it's also, I mean, we've disparaged it on this show in past
election
cycles precisely for being so exclusionary for the fact that people have to go out.
True. Having been there, having been there once, there is a certain magic to it.
There's a charm to it.
Charm would be the word.
What's the magic? Tell us.
It's very old school. You know, it's old school voting. You're there. You're engaging with your community, but you are correct. It is somewhat discriminatory. What if you're disabled? What if you don't have a car? What if you don't have the resources to get there? What if you have to work? So, but it does demand an engagement that we just don't demand anywhere else. You have to show up. It requires that you show up.
Arturo in East Harlem on the census. Arturo, you're on WNYC.
Yes, quickly, I'd like to say something. The fact is, this is all a residual of the incompetence of the 60s generation. For example, race is on all applications, and none of you protest that. I find that more offensive than placing whether one's an American citizen or not.
Yeah, you know, Arturo, I have a whole project called the Other Box Project on love, race, and identity, which is rooted in the race question that's been on the census from the very first census. That's the question that's been there from the beginning. They've changed the race categorizations, but they've always asked about race. And in the beginning, Arturo, they'd come to your door and they'd decide what race you were. You didn't get to decide for yourself, so it was even more offensive in the beginning. So yes, that's a real question. But again, the government says that it's for the purpose of apportioning resources. And Letitia James, our attorney general, is very, very eloquent on this issue of race and citizenship and the need to participate in the census and why we should engage with the census.
But do you think that to the extent that the census is asking people whether they're Hispanic or not, doesn't serve a similar purpose to discourage participation because they're afraid of being singled out?
No, it can.
Anyway.
It can. And I believe it's incumbent upon our leadership to explain why those questions are necessary and why it's important to answer and to engage with the process, why it's beneficial to our communities to be represented in the census.
All right. Now we'll turn to gerrymandering. And if you're just joining us, we're previewing the big decisions that will come down this month from the Supreme Court with our All Things Considered host and legal analyst, Jamie Floyd. Two different gerrymandering cases, that is, challenging the way congressional districts are drawn and other kinds of legislative districts are drawn. There's one that's challenging racial gerrymandering, specifically in Virginia, and another one that frames it differently as political gerrymandering being challenged in Maryland. Can you easily describe the difference between those two cases?
Right. Okay. So there are actually three total.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay?
Yep.
So there's a racial gerrymandering case in Virginia. And racial gerrymandering is pretty classic. The residents of Virginia say that there are new districts that were the product of unconstitutional racial gerrymandering, where they say black voters were legally packed or concentrated into a small number of districts, diluting their voting strength in nearby districting and diluting their voting strength in other districts so that Republicans, because the black voters were Democrats, would have more strength. This is just classic racial bias in the framing of these districts. So that's the Virginia case. Now, in Maryland and North Carolina, and this is the big case that Justice Ginsburg was talking
and
about.
And it was North Carolina that I left out there, right? It's a political gerrymandering challenge in both Maryland and North Carolina.
Correct. Now, race always comes into those cases as well. And the reason I like those two cases is the court is then looking at bipartisan gerrymandering. In Maryland, the Democrats are doing it. In North Carolina, the Republicans are doing it. And they're doing it according to political lines. They're cracking. So what they're doing is packing is when you pack everybody into one place so they have power in one small place but no power anywhere else. Cracking is when you, I love the North Carolina case. They have a historically black college and university down there. They split that college in half. They crack it, Brian, so that half the kids are voting in one district and half the kids are voting in another. I mean, that is classic cracking. We're going to dilute the power of this part of the district so that they don't have any power. And Republicans will maintain power in that part of the voting district in North Carolina. Now, the Democrats are doing the same thing in Maryland. Mm-hmm. Justice Kennedy and Justice Ginsburg were working together for the last 20 years to try and end this entrenchment of political power of the parties, because voters are supposed to have the power, not the political parties. And now it's unclear what's going to happen because we no longer have Justice Kennedy on the court. And the five conservative justices may say, well, this is the way the process works. We don't know. Maybe they won't. We don't know where Justice Kavanaugh will land on this. Mm-hmm. But really, it is supposed to be one person, one vote, not political parties reworking every 10 years after the census where we're going to adjust you so you vote where we tell you to vote. That's not how it's supposed to work.
Did you see on that note that Justice Ginsburg gave a speech on Friday, and one of her lines was, quote, however one comes out on the legal issues, partisan gerrymandering unsettles the fundamental premise that people elect their representatives, not vice versa.
Yes, and she was very careful in that speech on every other case. Very cautious in her language, even on the census case, which is, you know, arguably the most urgent of the cases before the court. And then next, I would say these. But she was clear in this case, I think, about where she's coming down.
We're almost out of time. Let's talk about this double jeopardy case, which has to do with one guy's gun and drug conviction, but may actually have implications for Trump world after the Mueller report.
That's right. So it basically starts out as a garden variety, low level felony case. And so the significance, the man's name is Gamble. And he gets caught up in a, you know, pretty traditional double jeopardy case. The rule, of course, as you know, Brian, we've talked about it many times, you can't be twice put in jeopardy for the same offense. And he takes his case all the way to the Supreme Court. But as you indicate, Brian, the significance here isn't in Mr. Gamble's case. It's in the Mueller case, because it's really about preserving the ability of state prosecutors to bring charges against defendants who were investigated and pursued by Robert Mueller, even if they receive pardons from President Trump for any federal charges against them. So can the state now pursue people like Paul Manafort? Really, I can't imagine the U.S. Supreme Court would unravel such a storied tradition, constitutional tradition, as the Double Jeopardy Clause. But it is before them, and they took it. I think probably to reaffirm it.
And
the argument was interesting, Brian, because they spent a lot of time talking about the value of precedent, which is key right now, right? Because of Roe versus Wade and other very critically important constitutional issues that are going to come before the court.
There is a question that's probably confusing a lot of people in our area right now over what double jeopardy actually is. Mm-hmm. Because here we have this news story in the last few days that Paul Manafort is going to Rikers Island. And the reason that that broke is that in addition to the federal charges against him, there are now New York State charges against him. And he is like any other inmate who is charged but not yet convicted, if they don't qualify for bail, going to where New York City holds people in that circumstance, and that's Rikers Island. There was, we should say by way of clarification, a misunderstanding that got out in some media last night that he was going to be held in solitary confinement. People objected to that on the show and elsewhere, when really I think the clarification is he's going to be held in isolation.
For his safety.
For his own protection, right, as prominent defendants sometimes are.
So I know we're very tight on time, and we can do a deep dive into double jeopardy when this case comes down. So we'll have time for that. But it does come up a lot, and it is confusing. There's another case we haven't talked about today, the Flowers case, where the man was tried six times. And the first thing people will say was, wait a minute, how can that be? Isn't that a violation of double jeopardy? So it comes up when people are tried multiple times in the same courthouse or when they're tried first in federal court and then in state court. You cannot be tried twice in our Constitution, but the exception is either when you have a hung jury or you have, obviously you can't be acquitted and then they pursue you again. But if you have a hung jury, you can be tried again by the same sovereign, or if it's different sovereigns with different interests or different facts that they can bring. So the state, the federal government, and Brian, we saw it a lot, of course, back in the 1960s when states would not seriously pursue people who violated the civil rights of black people during the civil rights movement, either murdering them or violating their rights in other ways. And then the federal government, the attorney general, would come in and pursue it seriously. And you can do that because you have a different set of interests under the civil rights laws in this country. So we can talk more about double jeopardy, but it essentially is because they are different sovereigns. It's not the same court coming in, the same prosecutor coming in and pursuing that prosecution.
Let me do our legal ID so the Federal Communications Commission doesn't suddenly take WNYC off the air. And then we're going to wrap this up with Jamie Floyd. This is This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public radio. You have to do that within 3 minutes of the top of the hour, every hour.
You made it.
Listeners, just so everybody knows what the rules are. Do you want to go a little more into the Flowers ruling? There is this. Well, all right. You know what? I'm going to change direction entirely to wrap this up. And I don't know if you can comment.
I can do Flowers in a second.
Go ahead.
He's going to get a new trial, or they're just going to throw it out altogether. I mean, that.
Yeah.
They were all appalled, including Kavanaugh, Alito. The only person who wasn't appalled, as we discussed, Brian, was Clarence Thomas.
Right.
So that case, I think that's a slam dunk.
And they,
so people know that's the man who was tried six times in Mississippi by the same prosecutor, and there was clear violation of his rights in the jury selection process, racial animus in the jury selection process.
And the state of New York, I think the legislature just changed what's called the double jeopardy loophole.
Yes.
So that it would make it easier for them to prosecute somebody like Paul Manafort?
Yes, correct.
After a presidential pardon?
Yes, yes, yes. In anticipation of what the Supreme Court is considering, going back to what we were just talking about, that is different from the Flowers case because Flowers was in the same courtroom six times. But what we're looking at with the Mueller defendants, and there are many of them, is concern that they might receive presidential pardons, and then could states like New York go after some of those defendants in state court. And some states, not many, but New York, had a loophole that might give those defendants a way around a prosecution in New York. And so they cleaned up the law a little bit.
Very interesting. Let me throw one other thing at you with your background as a defense attorney once upon a time.
Yeah.
And see if you have a thought on this. This is about, not the Supreme Court, but the Civilian Complaint Review Board case against Daniel Pantaleo, the officer in the death of Eric Garner.
Yes.
They've heard all the testimony now. Mm-hmm. And the big news at the end of last week was that they did not call Pantaleo himself to testify. Mm-hmm. Now, I think usually in court, only the defense gets to decide whether the defendant testifies or not. In this case, as I understand it, either the defense or the prosecution could have made Pantaleo testify, and they both chose not to, much to the chagrin of Gwen Carr, Eric Garner's mother, and others who really wanted to hear this guy forced to explain himself in his own words and under cross-examination.
Before a judge, not a jury, we should clarify. Before Judge Maldonado, who hears all of these, she's the senior administrative judge at the CCRB. So you are correct. In a criminal case, an ordinary criminal case, the defendant himself or herself themselves makes the decision whether or not to testify. Not even counsel is supposed to tell you whether or not to testify. You decide, sometimes to your detriment, whether to testify. In this proceeding, either side can call you because this is an administrative proceeding. We had a lot of talk in the newsroom about how to report this. Is it a trial? And I do understand, I don't want to second guess Gwen Carr and the family about their feelings on whether Pantaleo should have taken the stand. But there are always questions about the politics in these CCRB hearings. But my thought is that they really doubted whether it would benefit in front of this administrative judge who has a different relationship with these kinds of hearings to put him on the stand, that the evidence was strong without him. But you know, the person to ask on this, Brian, is Cindy Rodriguez.
Yes, and we're going to have her back in once this
she
gets...
She and Yasmin Khan covered this from front to back. They were in the room, and they have a much... legal analysis, but they have a factual assessment.
It's just interesting to me, among other things that are interesting, that they decided, that both sides decided it would not be in their interest to put him on the stand. So somebody's being...
These hearings are terribly troubling to me, the way the whole CCRB process works and has been for the 20 years I've been back in New York. It's not as transparent as it should be.
Our Jamie Floyd, we'll hear you on All Things Considered today. Thank you for coming in early for this. We have former Defense Secretary for President Obama, Ash Carter, standing by as our next guest after the latest news.